Hello, and welcome to this episode of the BDNG podcast. My name is Julia Wheeler, and I'm the Educational Development Nurse for the BDNG. We hope you enjoy listening to this series and find them beneficial to your practice. This first series of podcasts are sponsored by Almirall. Almirall has no influence over the content of these podcasts. Happy listening.
Hello and welcome to the official BDNG podcast. We are your hosts, Ashling Cleary and Emmanuel Tony, and we are both clinical nurse specialists in dermatology. Today, we are talking to Professor Nick Lavelle about the Getting It Right the First Time program and the proposed recommendations for dermatology. Welcome to the podcast, Nick.
Hiya. Very good. Very pleased that you've got me here.
Thank you. Would you like to introduce yourself, first of all?
So, yeah, I'm Nick Lavelle. I'm a consultant dermatologist in Norwich for the last 25 years, working with a big team of doctors and nurses here. I also work for GERFT, which is an NHS England programme, which I currently spend 2 days a week doing. I also have a job working for the National Institute of Health Research as well, which is another government programme, research programme as well.
Fantastic. So tell us about GERFT. So that's what we're here to talk about today.
Yeah. So it was set up about 6 or 7 years ago by Tim Briggs, who was president of the Orthopaedic Association. And he went around the country looking at variation in practice, looking at data and seeing how there was variation in practice between different hospitals. And he found several big areas of variation, which for orthopaedics were relevant as litigation, infection rates. And when he looked at the variation, he pointed it out to the trust and said, look, you've got a higher litigation rate than somebody else. What he found was that the trusts which weren't doing so well were really fast to improve their performance. And so they pulled themselves up. We're all naturally quite competitive as clinicians. We all want to work in the best hospital. So, he found this led to improvement in performance. So this, he went back to the Department of Health and they agreed to roll it out across other specialties. So they appointed leads competitively in different specialties. I applied for the dermatology job because it sounded interesting about 5 years ago. And since that time, I've been going around hospitals in England. It's an England programme. We did talk to Wales and Scotland about it, but they decided to do their own thing. So I've been around now 85 out of about 120 hospitals in England with significant dermatology units. And we take their data. We take along data packs which show their data and compare their data with other hospitals. And what I do is I have a two-hour meeting with the team, which is usually a mixture of the doctors, the nurses, the managers, sometimes commissioners, sometimes GPs, pharmacists, everybody who wants to come along, basically. And it's a very sort of iterative process. I present the data, say, what do you think about that? People talk about it. Out of it comes the problems, and not just problems, but the good things which hospitals are doing as well. And from that, we usually get a list of actions which we agree which can be done in the hospital. But also we often get examples of good practice, which I can then take and share with other people as well. Then at the end of it, I produce a report for each hospital after each visit, and then I produce the national report, which you've seen about a year ago now we wrote it, and it's been released to the trusts now under embargo, and hopefully it'll be released more generally soon.
I've just got a question about the data collection process. So was this something that you would do on site, or was it something that the sites did themselves? You would send the data points that you were collecting information on, or was it something that you and your team would turn up and collect data?
It was a mixture of both. What we did is I wrote round. I used to be president of the British Association of Dermatologists about 4 or 5 years ago. When I was doing that, I wrote round to all the dermatologists in the country and said, what are you doing well? And what do you think you could do better? And from that, I then constructed a questionnaire, which we then sent out to all the clinical leads. So most of the clinical leads were dermatologists, but some were nurses, some were managers. And they sent back, there was 130-odd questions they sent back, information on each department. I then had a team of people who were, we then had to think from the question, from the earlier questionnaire, what people were doing well and what people were doing less well. And we looked at things like HES data, cancer data. We looked at every possible data source we could find, and I had some analysts, and they collected the data in advance. So we it was a huge exercise, actually. We ended up with potentially probably 3 or 4 hours worth of data to go through for every trust, and had to really trim it down to something which I could realistically get through in a couple of hours. But it covered every aspect of the service, from phototherapy to patch testing, all aspects of the service, really, prescribing. And we managed to get data on nearly all these things. So, you know, for example, for prescribing, we could tell trusts what were their top 10 drugs in terms of use, and how that compared with other trusts' top 10 drugs. So we could see if their prescribing data was different or the same as other people. For phototherapy, we could see how many phototherapy cases they were doing per head of population compared to other people, patch testing similar, people who did surgery, how many biopsies you were doing, how many excisions. Everything we could find to measure, we measured. And we could let people benchmark their activity against other trusts to give them ad. So people were really interested to find out if they were doing more biopsies or less biopsies than other people, if they were doing a lot more follow-ups or less follow-ups than other people. They're also really interested in that. And, you know, if they're spending a huge amount on a drug which nobody else was using, then that was obviously quite interesting as well, you know. And so it wasn't, we went in it with a very open mind, because it didn't necessarily mean somebody was bad if you're doing something out of the ordinary. It might be something really good. Mm-hmm. So it was just saying, well, why are you doing that? And then discussing with them whether that was a reasonable thing to be doing or not. Yeah. So it's been a really interesting process.
It sounds like a lot of work as well, but a variation in, yeah, you know, in practice, you know, as you say yourself, has positives and negatives. Yeah. But with all that data that you've just mentioned, did you send that in a pack to the trust before you had your deep dive visit, yeah, or yeah, discussed when you were there?
So we sent them a pack out, which was about a 70-page pack, and it contained their data benchmarked against other trusts. So there were a lot of graphs which showed, which were anonymous except for the particular trust we sent it to, and it showed where they were compared to other people. We sent it a couple of weeks in advance. They were then supposed to share it around everybody going to the meeting. As it was all pretty technical, lots of really difficult graphs, lots of tables, some people looked at it really thoroughly, other people sort of looked at it and just bounced and just thought it's just too complex. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we went through it on the day. I assumed that people hadn't been through it on the day. Some people have been a lot. Some people, as you'd imagine, were very worried about it, because they thought we weren't the CQC. We're not going in to sort of penalise people. It's supposed to be a formative type process. So we were trying to support departments, but a few departments got very worried about it, felt threatened by it, and wanted to give me a presentation to start off with to show how their variation wasn't anything to be worried about. And of course, that wasn't what it was about. And so it was then trying to reassure them that it wasn't supposed to be something they needed to feel frightened about. It was about developing and about exploring what was being done well, and about identifying their problems with them and agreeing, hopefully, with them and their managers, a plan to go forward. And so hopefully most trusts found it very useful as a way of sort of what I was doing was facilitating them, explaining often to their teams around them what they really wanted to do, and either sort of saying that was a reasonable thing to do, or perhaps saying this is another way you could do it better, and then giving them a plan to help them develop their department. And that was what the aim was anyway. And I guess you'd have to speak. I got some nice feedback from a few departments, but you'd have to speak to the departments to see whether that actually worked or not. But yeah, they got the packs in advance, and then they each got their own personal report afterwards, which I wrote that evening. It was a 3,000 or 4,000 word report for each department, which we sent out on the day to them. And I say the three main findings, which were typical findings we got, were number one, training shortage, problems with shortage of doctors. So training up more doctors through the CESA process. Number two, developing the multidisciplinary team, which I guess is very probably which you're mainly interested in for this talk, which is about developing specialist nurses, something about developing pharmacists. And number three was about using new technology. And that was all about developing advice and guidance, developing teledermatology, seeing how everybody's doing that differently everywhere, and trying to sort of pull together what people were doing. And the attitudes are very different as well.
It's definitely interesting.
But there are lots of other areas as well. But those are the three key areas we looked at.
It's funny you should mention teledermatology, because I feel that's something that's completely unavoidable over the past year with the COVID pandemic. It's kind of almost been forced onto all of us in dermatology.
It's very interesting. In 2012, I did a survey of all dermatologists, which found about half were in favour, half were opposed to it. People in favour saying it saved time, it shortened the patient journey. People not in favour saying you missed things and you couldn't get the detail, you couldn't get the sort of close relationship with the patient. And I guess it's a bit of those things. I'm tempted to sort of set some offence about it. I think it's a useful tool which has its place, but it can't replace the sort of holistic care you can give to somebody when you're meeting them face to face.
Yes, in practice, it certainly is a fine balance. Picking up on the recommendation to further develop the multidisciplinary team and specialist nurses, can you provide us with a little bit more context there?
Well, it was one of the big areas which we really felt was important. And when I was president of the BAD, I went abroad and lectured in a few places talking about, and in a couple of places, I was actually asked to talk about dermatology nursing, rather strangely, as a doctor, which perhaps sums it up, the attitude of some countries towards dermatology nursing. They asked the doctor to go and talk about nursing.
Yes.
And that really did sort of sum it up, because when I sort of started talking to them about some of the data which we had identified with GERFT, which, you know, we identified, for example, that I've got it here to my right hand, which I'm just referring to, that back in 2 or 3 years ago when we did this, that two-thirds of the trusts had nurse prescribers, you know, and in terms of surgery, 58% of trusts had nurses doing a lips excision surgery. When I presented that to an international audience, Americans just said, oh, yeah, that's fine, yeah, it's normal, yeah. Some countries, I won't say which, were absolutely horrified. And I got responses back to me saying that you're ruining the profession, you're going to undermine and destroy the profession by allowing nurses to do this. This was the seriously held opinion of leaders in a number of countries, I wouldn't say which, a number of countries around the world, who were quite horrified by this. And when I sort of said, well, hang on, doesn't it strengthen you to be part of the team and to work with people and to be part of a bigger team? Isn't it better if you're offering a better service to more patients with more people and you have a multidisciplinary team? Aren't we all stronger when we work with more people? There's a lot of sort of, we're much stronger if we work by ourselves, coming back. And so it's really interesting attitude, which I found. So it's one of the things that I went in with a sort of and in Norwich, I've been working with Carrie Wingfield, who's our my nurse consultant colleague in Norwich for the last 25 years. And together with my other consultant colleagues in developing the nurses in nursing roles in Norwich. And, Carrie's developed the nurse consultant role for herself and has now developed this nurse registrar role, which is developing nurses on a pathway to becoming nurse consultants. We've got the first one of our nurses, Kate Davis, is due to complete that, I hope, in the next month or so as a nurse consultant, having been through a training program to become a nurse consultant.
Excellent.
So we had a lot of things, really exciting things going on in Norwich. We've been working on lots of nurse prescribing. So for me, faced with the fact that we've got a shortage of provision in secondary care, and faced with the fact that the Department of Health had made pretty clear to us they weren't going to be keen on increasing doctor numbers enough to tackle the problem, it's a no-brainer to be able to say you've got to develop the multidisciplinary team in order to be able to sort this out. And combine the fact we've got a team of over 1,000 very capable, very able nurses in England in dermatology who want to develop into this role, who are doing it already, who have been led by the BDNG, led by some amazing leaders in nursing, then it was an obvious thing to my mind that we should be doing this. And in fact, I was pushing on an open door most trusts I went to, I was pushing on an open door doing this, and the doctors were saying, oh, this is what we've been trying to tell our managers for years, who want to develop nurses, specialist nurses, but we just can't do it. And so that was one way in which I could sort of assert and say, look, explain to the managers this was actually a sensible and cost-effective and quicker way of solving them for a workforce crisis rather than trying to train up a dozen more consultants from scratch. You know, this was part of the solution. You know, it's a multifaceted solution. And the same thing we're talking about pharmacists as well. And we weren't forgetting the HCAs as well. We talk about this, the HCAs in dermatology are still a bit of a forgotten workforce, I think. Mm-hmm. There still need to be better ways to be able to reward, recognise the HCAs and to be able to support the HCAs who want to progress or move on into trained nurse roles. It's still not straightforward for them to be able to do that. We weren't particularly wedded just to the nurse consultant model as well. I know different trusts are doing it in different ways with advanced clinical practitioners and various other initiatives. So what we were saying to them is a lot of the time our conclusion was the trust, one of the actions of the trust was to do a workforce review and to come up with a plan in line with their trust policy about how to develop nurses, whether it's as consultant nurses or as clinical practitioners, but whatever, it's nurses into the appropriate band to be nurse leaders. We quite liked the nurse consultant role because it meant the nurses were actually taking responsibility for the patients, mm-hmm. And had overall responsibility for patients. We felt that sort of empowered nurses to develop further in their career, and then provided a motivation for people to stay in the nursing profession. I've occasionally met nurses, hopefully not in Norwich, but in certainly in other trusts, where trained nurses said they feel they've hit a glass ceiling, they can't go any higher, and they're thinking of leaving nursing to go and do something else because they can't progress. And that is such a shame, isn't it, when you hear that? And you just think we've totally got it wrong. If we train people up to have all these skills, and then they go off and become a, you know, it might be if they want to do that, that's fine. But if they're feeling they have to do it, they go off and do a career in something else completely different because they can't progress in nursing. That's just a waste.
I think that's one of the main kind of differences between the doctor's experience and nurse's experience. Because so you've got your trainee post as a doctor where you train up and then one day hopefully become a consultant. Whereas nurses, there isn't really that structured approach. So it's really refreshing to hear that you're trying to introduce things like that. I know that I would love something like that where I work.
Yeah, and I suppose that ties in nicely with the role descriptors framework that the BAD and BDNG created.
Absolutely. It's one of our recommendations. I don't know if you spotted it. One of our recommendations was that should be adopted across England to try and get consistency across between trusts and to avoid people, you know, getting poached by a rival trust who's offering them more money for doing the same. If everybody was being offered the same money for doing the same job, then hopefully it means people move because they want to move to a better department, not because they're not being paid properly for what they've been doing in a particular place. That was really important. But it was really exciting to see the way a lot of managers really picked up on I'd say probably half the trusts I went to, the managers really got excited about the thought of getting the nurses seeing new patients with skin cancer, you know, because they're all completely worried about the 2-week waits building up. Yeah. I said, well, you can train nurses very, you know, it's a straightforward process. Find the right nurse who wants to do it. Get him or her to learn how to see new 2-week waits in clinic. They can then learn how to do the excision surgery themselves and can take to the MDT and manage the patient. As long as they're doing that with a team of doctors who are prepared to support them in this as they go through a training process, eventually those nurses will get to the stage. You know, my colleague Carrie Wingfield's been doing that for years, and she can now teach our registrars, our medical registrars, what to be doing about that. So, you know, she can teach them surgery. It was really good to see the managers pick up on this and understand, gain an understanding of how we could develop the multidisciplinary workforce, which I'm sure is the way forward. And it's not just in clinical work. I'll put on my research hat as well and say, you know, it's in research as well. We need to be developing nurses who I think we should be developing nurses to give them the opportunity to do the clinical work, mm-hmm. but also if they're interested, do some research work alongside that. So as you said before, you know, for doctors, we can do that. I'm doing this management role for 2 days a week with NHS England. but I'm also still doing research, which I find really interesting and stimulating. It keeps me alive. I'm still seeing patients. So I can combine all those things. But no reason why nurses can't do that. But the problem is there just isn't the career framework to do that at the moment. And because of that, you're then losing nurses who've got a choice. You can either go and become just a purely administrator or hospital manager, or you can go and work for a pharmaceutical company, or you can go do something different, but it doesn't seem to be that pathway in the hospital. So I suppose it's that motivation, really, which you know, that desire to produce a career pathway so that we kept people in. And I was really amazed. I met some amazing consultant nurses going around the country and, you know, bumped into Sandra Lawton again up in Rotherham, who I've known for years when she was in Nottingham, and she's now up in Rotherham. And, you know, I don't care what I say now. I thought
we could delete it.
She retired from Nottingham, I thought, but then she moved up to Rotherham and was looking younger than ever. She always looks younger than me anyway, and was working away there.
I'm sure
still.
She's blushing right now.
Yeah, I find that every BDNG conference I go to, everyone seems to get younger each year.
Absolutely, yeah. But there's some amazing consultant nurses doing great. You know, she and a colleague up in Rotherham were running the service, which basically would have fallen apart completely because the doctor had retired, was still coming back doing a bit of work, but they were completely keeping the service afloat in Rotherham. So, and there are other examples I saw around the country where experienced nurses were basically holding the fort while the trust was trying to appoint some local consultants, get people in. It was a really big part of the project was to try and push that. The key thing about the GERS thing is it's an iterative process. So I'm hoping if they don't sack me, that we'll keep going and we'll keep on going.
Great.
Round. We'll go back to, maybe not back to the individual trusts, but to groups of trusts, see how's it gone.
Yeah.
And hopefully we can keep on with this process of just developing departments. And looking at how other people are doing, learning from best practice in different places, because I think still a lot of work to be done. It's, you know, we're not there yet at all, are we? I don't think.
No, I think it's a great project, and you know, for me, it's just the power of information sharing between trusts that is vital. But just in that last analogy, just when you were talking, me and Ashton were smiling ear to ear, only because we've known each other a few years. We worked in dermatology research together, and we both used to say, we want to be more clinical. Why can't we do, you know, a few days a week of research dermatology and a few days a week of clinical dermatology and learn how to be a CNS as well? But at that point in time, it was a bit political in the powers that be in the trust. So it was kind of stopped, but it was just so refreshing to hear you say that, because we both used to say it. It would make so much more sense.
Yeah, I actually did a half and half role, tried to make it continue, but unfortunately it didn't. I kind of had to choose. So I went down the CNS route purely because in dermatology research as well, there's a cap, there's management. But at least now you can be a nurse PI, which is very exciting for like...
I mean, I think that's right. I mean, with my role in the NIHR, we've been trying to develop nurse PIs across the country. And it was our main performance target. It's a different role from GERF, but in my NIHR, I'm the national specialty lead for the NIHR as well. Mm-hmm. And in that role, we made developing nurse PIs our main sort of target for each region to do. But I mean, I think what I'd say to nurses listening to this is that, you know, it's now I'd say it's a challenge. I'll give it as a challenge to people of your generation to take it forward. Because I mean, I think the nursing profession has a huge potential to develop into exactly what we were just talking about, roles which are clinical, research, education as well, and managerial. And it's where, you know, in the same way you can as a doctor, you can do that. There's no reason why you shouldn't be able to do that as a nurse. And it's just a question of the leaders doing it, demonstrating it can be done, and then really working with BDNG to write the job plans and to show how this benefits patients. We know that people who do research, clinical research, have better clinical outcomes. We know that people educate tend to be better, have better knowledge. And so if you combine it all together, it should all be virtuous circles, which improve people's performance for people who want to do it. I mean, that's the other thing, is not to force people through. You know, in medicine, we've got people who want to just sit there and see patients and love it and don't want to go and have to do research and do education. So it's the flexibility so that you don't force people into roles they don't want to be, because I've got some hugely respected colleagues in Norwich who really don't want to go and become researchers. You know, they're really happy with what they're doing. And I've talked to them about it. They say, no, I love what I'm doing. I just want to carry on doing it. But it's offering that flexibility, isn't it, for nursing careers? I guess not just in dermatology, but across all specialties. So it's, I suppose, it's something for Royal College of Nursing to take on. I'll give you a sort of personal detail. My daughter's just got a place to go and train as a nurse last week, she told me. And she approached me and said, Charlotte, you know, we talked about medicine, we talked about nursing. I said, go and do nursing. I said, I actually think, you know, there's a lot going for nursing in the future. You might actually have a better career as a nurse, the way I think it's going to develop anyway. So
I think you're right. Even if you look back the last 20, 30, you know, 40, 50 years, the role expansion of nurses has just gone further and further. Mm. As in giving IV antibiotics used to be a doctor-only procedure. But now, as in, when I was on the wards anyway, I can't remember the last time I saw a doctor put up a bag of antibiotics for a patient. It's all nurses.
Yeah, and nurses didn't used to take blood and, when I was a junior doctor, I spent my whole time going around to giving IVs. Yeah, so the roles have changed completely, and I think we'll continue to change as long as there's people pushing to do that. And I think we'll end up. I think in the future there'll be a breaking down of, sort of a lot of traditional barriers between professional groups, and there'll be breaking down between specialties as well. Specialisms, there'll be reforming specialisms as well. That's possibly a bigger subject.
Yes, definitely. Exciting times ahead with the expansion of the nursing role. So taking you back to another main finding of the report, which we touched on earlier, can you tell us a little bit more about new digital technologies and artificial intelligence, and as well as how they can help provide effective care?
Teledermatology undoubtedly offers advantages in terms of saving patients travelling. It's an opportunity for doctors and nurses in the community to quickly get an opinion from hospital experts. So that's an advantage of it. Mm-hmm. And it's particularly good when people can't travel long distances. There are some disadvantages in terms you don't get the face-to-face communication. And we all know, you know, or certainly I believe that a lot of communication is about body language, as well as from just verbal communication. And I think you lose some of that. And a lot of the body language is really important in a consultation. So I think there is a role for it, perhaps more with follow-ups, and for patients who have difficulty travelling. But I think the other really exciting areas linked to teledermatology is artificial intelligence, because that will become, it's work going on artificial intelligence, both diagnosis and management. And I anticipate that by using teledermatology, attached to that, there'll also be artificial intelligence, which will be listening to what we're saying in terms of both diagnosis and in terms of management, and probably giving us prompts as to what could be wrong with the patient, what questions we should be asking, what we should be doing. So I think that aspect of the sort of future of technology is really exciting. I see teledermatology as being a tool for good practice, though, rather than a means or an end to itself. I don't think we should, let's go and do teledermatology. It should be putting the patient in the centre. What does the patient need? Mm-hmm. And how can teledermatology benefit what the patient needs? Rather than we've got some teledermatology here, let's go and do it to loads of patients and see if they like it or not. It's better to start off with the patient in the middle and then work out how that could improve their service. The other thing is the cost of it. Is although it saves journeys and it saves space in the hospital, whether you end up having more consultations with teledermatology, and with those additional consultations for time, actually costs more than just seeing the patient once, mm-hmm. getting the diagnosis and discharging them. I've been struck by the fact that as the waiting lists have gone up, teledermatology shot up. And I've been to a few trusts, one or two trusts, which have got almost no waiting lists. Over COVID, one or two trusts were amazing. They got rid of their waiting list almost completely. And those trusts said to me, well, actually, we hardly do any teledermatology now because we haven't got a waiting list anymore. And the patients can just come in. And so it's sort of, you know, so it's an interesting one. I think it's definitely a tool which is with us, which will be to stay here to stay. But I think we have to make sure that we use it to improve the patient experience, not to make lives easier for ourselves. Mm-hmm. I think that'd be my key message.
Yeah, no, I kind of completely agree with what you're saying there, because sometimes you end up having, I suppose, the same consultation twice because you realise on the phone that they need to come in, or they're sending in photos, or you're waiting for bloods, and all of that time, it just ends up being way longer than the visit, the one-off visit in clinic. So completely agree with you there. This is a bit off topic, but I'd seen some information about this model health system portal. Would you be able to give us a bit of information on that? Is that where you store all the information that you've gathered from the trust?
Model
hospitals. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it is an area where we're trying to build up, where you're putting in sort of best practice. What I've been asked to do is to try and produce pathways now, which I'm looking at for different parts of dermatology. And what we're trying to identify is can you build performance indicators into the pathways? But that's actually very difficult. Mm-hmm. It's easier if you're doing a surgical procedure, and you just look at infection rates, and you could look at basal cell carcinoma has been excised and say what proportion have been fully excised and what's the patient satisfaction afterwards. So for a procedure, it's quite easy. If you're dealing with a small child with eczema, it's much more difficult to have an objective measure. You can have patient satisfaction, which is a good measure, or parent satisfaction. But other than that, it's quite hard to measure objectively whether the consultation's been effective or not. So it's something which we're working on. It's probably better for surgical aspects of dermatology. There's some things which are easy to measure. You can look at follow-up rates, and you know we identified through GERF that certain follow-up rates, most people seem to be able to achieve certain follow-up rates, but a very long follow-up rate isn't ideal. You know, if you've got a large number of follow-ups, possibly you bring the patients back and back again, and why aren't they getting better and you're discharging them? There's some things we can measure, like follow-up rates, but even with that, it depends on how good your GPs are. If you've got really good GPs who diagnose everything simple and do it themselves, then the only patients who they'll refer up to hospitals are people with really complex problems who will need a large number of follow-ups. If you're working in a specialist tertiary referral centre, again, you'll have a high number of follow-ups. Mm-hmm. Whereas you've got GPs or people referring people in from the community who really don't know any dermatology and are sending up all the benign lesions to be seen, you'll have a massively high discharge rate and a very low follow-up rate. So you look like you're really good, but all in fact you're measuring is the fact that you've been referred in the wrong patient. So all the measures which you've got have to be looked at very carefully. And you can't just have a single measure to sort of say, this is what's good and what's bad in my experience. So we're sort of doing work on that. We're trying to work with the Department of Health, trying to sort of explain this to them, trying to produce pathways, but not trying to... The problem is if you produce a target, which is not a sort of sensible target like follow-up rates, all which you do is you encourage people to play games to meet the target, and then people are playing games for patients, right. Which yeah. Obviously isn't going to benefit the patient if people are discharging people who don't need discharging or you know. So the real key thing is to avoid people gaming, using patients as gaming, because they've been forced to try and meet some target. That's really important not to do that.
And who would have access to this once it's established? Would it just be
Model hospitals team. Accessible now? You can access it. It's accessible to NHS employees.
Okay.
As nurses, you can access it. Yeah.
And how do we access it?
I would have to Google Model Hospital.
Oh, sorry.
And email them and say, please have access. Is the way I think I do it. But I just click on it, Google it, and then tap in my password and go in. But I don't think it's. I think you have to have access through an NHS password. I think. But,
yeah.
But that's something I'm not absolutely sure about. I can't. To be honest, I belong to so many different systems. I can't remember how I get access more.
Yeah. But I'm picking up on something that you said about, we'll say the community service, and, you know, we know all about GPSIs, but what is there any recommendations that support, you know, GP practice nurses getting more involved with dermatology so that, you know, again, they're kind of an added resource to help prevent unnecessary referrals?
I mean, GIRFT was mainly secondary care, but we did have a lot of GPs who came along. We had some examples of intermediate care services which worked well. I think the key thing was, and there's also a lot of stuff about education. One of the problems which we identified is that there's, as I say, there's a variable amount of knowledge out there in the community. Some people know a lot of dermatology and some people don't know very much. So one of the key findings was to try and make sure that dermatology education began at the undergraduate level for doctors, nurses and pharmacists and continued through. And so that we'd hope that everybody would get a basic level of dermatology education sufficient to be able to do their job well. Mm-hmm. So particularly for nurses working in practices. I mean, I get a lot of referrals up from nurses, particularly on advice and guidance, and some of them are really good referrals. You know, a lot of them are nurses who I know well in Norfolk who I've worked with for a long time, but some of them you feel really sorry for them because it's some poor nurse who's not really got any dermatology experience. He or she has been stuck in the position of being told you're going to see all the skin problems, and suddenly they've been asked to make decisions, is this a melanoma, isn't this a melanoma, when really they've not had any training to do that. So one of the things we've been talking a lot about is that people should analyse their referrals, their advice and guidance referrals, by practice, and even by individual practitioner, and then look to support the people who've got high numbers of referrals. And it's trying to do that in a way which doesn't look like it's patronising, but try and look at education. One of the ways we've thought about doing that is when we've talked about employment of or producing consultant nurses or specialist nurses, is encourage specialist nurses working, first of all, between hospitals, and also between hospitals and community. So the idea is that to have a consultant nurse who is working maybe some sessions in the hospital and a few sessions out in the community, but the community sessions probably be more about education than about just service delivery, because obviously there's such a huge mass of work out there in the community, it's difficult to all that, but there's certainly an educational role. My colleague, Carrie Wingfield, who is my nurse consultant colleague, years and years ago, we both used to lecture on a community nurse, district nurse, leg ulcer course. And I think I started off doing it, and then Carrie took over from me, just talking about treating the dermatology aspects of managing leg ulcers. Education, people working across, getting rid of the sort of division between primary care and secondary care, looking at it as a whole system, trying to look at how to improve the system, people with job roles which moved across between the two.
Yeah, that does sound like the ideal model to aim for, you know, creating much needed support and education for clinicians in the community, which I suppose by virtue should naturally improve the patient's journey and experience. Going back to the report and implementation of these recommendations, how should they be prioritised and actioned by individual trusts?
So what we did, there's two levels of report. We had the individual trust reports which we sent out. So a typical trust report will have been sent out to your trust with three or four actions and then about 10 lower level recommendations. And so the idea of the actions were things which everybody had signed up to in the meeting. Mm-hmm. And then those are the key ones to carry forward. And there are lots of lower level recommendations, realizing it's not possible to change the world in a short period of time. But in terms of implementation, what is supposed to happen is that the trusts are supposed to organise meetings with their dermatologists and their managers to implement the changes which have been made. And within each trust, there are GIRFT representatives, people working for NHS Improvement, usually who are doctors, senior doctors, who have one or two sessions a week to just make sure that these changes are being implemented. But at, you know, terms changing over time. NHS England is changing, and it's merged with NHS Improvement now. So there's new people coming into into place, and I've been involved in trying to select people, clinicians, who have a job of trying to implement these changes. But to some degree, it's so that's the local level. Then we've got the national level recommendations, which are in the pack. That's now been sent out to every trust. And anybody who wants a copy of the national GERF National Report for Dermatology can email me, nick.lavelle@nuh.nhs.uk. As long as you've got an NHS, if you don't get that, just Google Nick Lavelle and you'll find my email address. And I can then say, as long as you've got an NHS email address, I can send you a copy of the national report, which has got all the recommendations in it, and you can then use that to take it to your trust team, to your managers, and say, look, this is what we want to do. You know, this is the evidence behind it.
Oh, fantastic. And you yourself, have you got any plans made to revisit yet, or is this still up in the air?
Well, it depends. It depends if I'm allowed to. I've seen 85 of about 115 trusts. What's happened is a lot... Most people really happy for it, wanted us to come and visit. But there's always a few people who are frightened or just can't get round to it, or sometimes they're just too busy. And, you know, so there's some trusts we haven't yet got round to. So we're hoping that we can get round to the last few trusts. And we're doing those visits virtually through Zoom, which isn't as good, to my mind, as doing it through face-to-face. But to some degree, we just need to make sure we've gone through the process, we've had this, we've got a report, we understand what it's about. So we're just trying to get through the last few trusts now, the next few months. And then, as I say, what I want to do is try, look, I've already done three or four of them. We've gone back to regions and we've done a meeting with several trusts together with the STPs or the CCGs to try and look at a way of trusts working together to improve their services and to come up with a regional plan.
And if a nurse that is listening to this has thought, oh, I'd like to sign my trust up to this, how would they go about doing that?
Well, every trust should have, has been invited. Every trust, back in November 18 when we started off, we wrote an email, I sent an email out to every departmental lead and to every trust inviting, saying, and so we've been round to 85 of 115 England trusts now. So ones who we haven't been round to, what they need to do is have a chat with their clinical director, their service director, and just say, look, can you get in contact with GERFT and request for visit? And as soon as they get in contact with request to visit, we'll go and do it. We're not really in the business of strong-arming our way in there. So, you know, I've still got visits, which I'm doing regularly now. And so as word is getting round that it isn't something to be frightened of, and it is something which is potentially useful, where people are signing up for it. But yeah, if there's nurses who work in trusts which haven't yet been visited, first of all, check you haven't been visited by actually, because it may be that I've visited, you just weren't invited, to the meeting. You didn't know about it. I've sent a report out. But there were a few trusts where I went to it, and I was quite disappointed by how, most were fine, got a good team in, but there were a few where I was a bit disappointed about. The whole team obviously hadn't been invited along. I think they were maybe waiting to see what I said before they sort of shared it with the team. So just check to see if there is actually a report there for yourselves, because there might be one which I've done already. And if there isn't, then get your clinical lead to contact me, contact GERFT, and organise it. But they've all got the invitation. All the trusts have been invited.
So thank you so much, Nick, for coming on and speaking to us about the GERF report. With the increasing demand for dermatology services, I am absolutely sure these recommendations will be welcomed with open arms. We have managed to get through quite a bit this evening. We have discussed variation in practice between trusts, addressing shortages in the workplace, teledermatology, and the continuous role expansion in dermatology nursing. So thank you again. You might share your email with us once more for those in the back, and if you have any final words to leave us with.
So yes, it's nick.lavelle, nick.lavelle@nnuh.nhs.uk. But if you just Google Nick Lavelle email, you'll find it there. And then if you email me asking for a copy of the National GERD report, as long as you email me from an NHS address, I can send it to you. So one final word is that UK dermatology nursing is world leading. You're the best in the world. And it's not been shouted about enough. And what I'd encourage you to do is to go out there on the world stage and let them know what you're doing, because it really is world leading. You know, in medicine, you know, dermatology is up there. We're good. We're up with Germany and in America and France and everybody else. But dermatology nursing is absolutely at the top, you see, in the UK. And so someone needs to go out and shout about it and say, look what we're doing here. And sort of share this across the world, because the message should be going out there. So I'll leave you with that thought. Thank you very much for having me here, and it's been a pleasure speaking to you. I hope people are still awake. If they are,
yeah, thank you very much for leaving us with blushing cheeks there.
Yeah, such a positive note. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode. For further information and details of our upcoming events, visit our website, bdng.org.uk, and watch out for the next BDNG podcasts, which are coming soon.